Boston. And in the NBA playoffs, it's Indiana and Miami this evening. I'm Jeff Bosser, Illinois Public Media News.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Let's take a look at your Champaign-Urbana weather for the rest of today. Mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of showers and a high of 75. Southwest winds of 10 to 15 miles per hour are expected for the rest of the day. Tonight, mostly cloudy, 40% chance of rain and a low of 54. West winds of about 15 miles an hour tonight, so it's relatively windy. Thursday, mostly cloudy, 40% chance of rain and cooler with a high of only 66. That's about 20 degrees less than we saw at the beginning of the week. Northwest winds getting up to about 20 miles per hour, which should cut the temperature even more. By Thursday night, it will be cold with a low of 42, mostly clear. North winds 10 to 15 miles an hour getting up to about 30 in the evening. By Friday, the temperature is going to stay in the 60s. We're seeing a high of only 65 degrees, and that's going to hold over into the weekend when we have a 30% chance of showers on Saturday and Sunday. Let's take a look at some temperatures around the state this hour. In DeKalb right now, light rain at 64 degrees. Chicago at O'Hare Airport, cloudy and 71 at the moment. In Macomb, it's cloudy and 72. In Decatur and Peoria, it's fair, 73 degrees in Decatur, 69 in Peoria at the moment. In Springfield, it's 73 and fair right now. In Champaign at Willard Airport, it's cloudy with some light rain and 68 degrees, 67 at Friends Plaza in Urbana outside of our studios. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. As Congress fiddles with major farm legislation, there's a portion of it that gets very little attention. Yet supporters say that it is a difference maker when it comes to job creation in small rural communities and that it provides a boost that many towns need. Harvest Public Media's Bill Wheelhouse has this report.
Who's going to come back and do that? Chris?
Staunton, Illinois Mayor Craig Newhouse is watching $9 million go down the drain in a good way. He's checking the details as workers put the community's new water plant online while pumps push the water through the treatment system. The 5,000 residents of Staunton who lost water for 5 days last year because of a problem at the old plant will soon have the latest in water technology. But for this rural community about a half hour north of St. Louis, the mayor hopes the water system upgrade helps bring business to town.
These companies come in, the first thing they're going to ask is, what is your infrastructure? I mean, if you don't have sewer and water, they don't want to come. You know, they don't want to build out. They're not like building out and putting septic tanks to run this big business or company for your jobs.
This talk of jobs isn't just a vague hope. The new plant was made possible by a low-interest 40-year loan funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Program. The federal program, an often overlooked part of the farm bill, supports non-farm projects that backers say are critical to the economic vitality of rural communities. That amounted to about $30 billion in mostly loan guarantees and grants in 2012. The USDA's Doug O'Brien can tick off a list of success stories, such as libraries that were built or rural health care programs expanded. A large chunk goes to housing loans. But infrastructure, he says, is the bread and butter of rural development.
When you drive across rural America and you see that classic water tower, there's a very good chance that USDA Rural Development was there to provide a grant loan mix so that basically we can get to a place that that water system can afford to sustain itself.
O'Brien is the USDA's acting undersecretary for rural development, so he's clearly an advocate for the government's commitment to these programs. But not everyone's a fan. Critics say loan programs could be handled by the private sector and that rural development is a relic of the New Deal of the 1930s. And reports from the Government Accountability Office have raised questions about whether rural development programs duplicates work at other federal agencies, such as the Department of Commerce or Small Business Administration. The libertarian Cato Institute questions whether the money spent actually delivers promised jobs. Congress has cut the program's funding by a third in the last decade, and if that trend continues,
it'll be an accelerated deterioration, I would say, of the rural quality of life.
Chris Merritt is director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs. He monitors the rural economy and efforts to revive it. He says this particular bit of funding may be small in the scheme of the Farm Bill, but it has a mighty impact.
You know, it's the idea that the farm economy is more than just simply farms, and that a healthy agricultural sector needs a healthy rural non-farm sector, and it implies, you know, everything that somebody in the suburbs would take for granted.
He and others point out there are fewer farm lawmakers in Congress making sure the money gets funneled to rural economic development. And with Farm Bill attention directed at the big money items like crop insurance and food stamp programs, it's even hard for lawmakers on the congressional ag committees to remember it. So it's not just the farm interest that will keep tabs on what Congress is doing with ag spending. It's also towns like Staunton that face big challenges to their economies and communities that hope the government can help them reduce or eliminate problems like going without water for a week. Bill Wheelhouse, Harvest Public Media.
House and Senate versions of the Farm Bill passed out of the Ag Committees in mid-May. The funding status of the various rural development programs all remain in flux at the moment, though the House bill would eliminate 13 programs and reduce funding levels by more than $1.5 billion over the next 5 years. You can see all of our ag coverage on our website, will.illinois.edu. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. Apple Incorporated is the focus of a U.S. Senate investigation for using Irish subsidiaries to reduce its tax liability by billions of dollars. NPR's Zoe Chase from Planet Money explains how Apple did it and why Ireland.
When a company like Apple doesn't pay taxes, Congress doesn't like it. Here's Senator John McCain.
Apple's three primary Irish entities hold 60% of the company's profits, but claim to be tax residents nowhere in the world.
They call it nowhere income. You can have income that's just not sourced anywhere because of different countries' different tax rules.
Daniel Gottfried is a tax lawyer. We looked at Apple's situation together. He says what Apple's doing is perfectly legal and common. Apple has a couple subsidiary companies in Ireland. Let's highlight one, Apple Operations International. It's a holding company, a company of companies. It has an address in Ireland, but there's nobody there. The company has no employees. Here's what Apple Operations International does. It holds European iPhone money. If you buy an iPhone in Brussels, that money gets transferred to a company, which transfers it to another company, then another company, which transfers it to Apple Operations International. And there it sits. So why no taxes in Ireland? Because of a quirk in the Irish tax code. If the company is managed somewhere else, Apple Operations International, for example, managed out of California, it pays no Irish taxes. Opposite quirk in U.S. law, a company that's incorporated outside of the U.S. also doesn't pay taxes here, even if it's managed out of California. This has been going on for more than 30 years. Here's Apple CEO Tim Cook testifying before Congress yesterday.
We went to Ireland in 1980, and they were very much recruiting, I believe, technology companies at that time. And as a part of recruiting us, the Irish government did give us a tax incentive agreement.
It's been a fundamental part of Ireland's economic strategy to get foreign companies to set up operations in Ireland. They offer these really low corporate tax rates. In Apple's case, not all their subsidiaries pay zero taxes, but the taxes they do pay are much, much lower than what they'd pay in the U.S., on the order of 30 percentage points lower. And whose idea was it that the Irish corporate tax rate rip off the U.S. government? Essentially, the U.S. government itself. It dates back to rebuilding money Ireland got from the U.S. right after the war. Frank Barry is an Irish economist who studied Irish tax history. He says the first thing Ireland did when it got the U.S. money was to ask for advice on how to spend it.
Amongst the things we did was we hired a group of U.S. consultants. They issued a 100-page report to the Irish government.
And tucked into this 100-page report, on a single page, the consultants
drew Ireland's attention to the case of Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, the consultants noted, had done very well in the post-war period by lowering its corporate tax rate.
To lure U.S. multinational corporations to set up production in Puerto Rico and export back to the U.S.
Oh, that single page in the 100-page report turned out to be the very best part, even though
the U.S. consultants downplayed it. They said this is probably not relevant to the Irish situation, but our bureaucrats here spotted it and said this has the makings of a very good idea.
Ireland, the tax shelter, was born in the style of Puerto Rico, with State Department funds. This, of course, was not the Americans' intention. In fact, the report started out quite boldly.
The single opening line says, in the Irish economy, cattle is king.
Not anymore. Zoe Chase, NPR News.
WILL programming is made possible by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, since 1990, offering U of I faculty, staff, and employees planning advice and retirement solutions designed to balance current needs and provide for future financial security. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 22nd of May, 2013. It's the birthday of Arthur Conan Doyle, born Edinburgh, 1859, studied medicine at the University of Edinburgh. His favorite professor was Joseph Bell, who taught his students how to make a successful diagnosis through observation and deduction. Doyle went into the practice of medicine after graduating, wrote fiction in his spare time, and in 1887, in the story A Study in Scarlet, he created a character based on his old professor, the detective Sherlock Holmes, who said, "Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. Nothing clears up a case so much as stating it to another person." And the person whom Sherlock Holmes stated his cases to, of course, was a doctor, Dr. Watson. Holmes said, "You have a grand gift for silence, Watson. It makes you quite invaluable as a companion." Conan Doyle ended up writing 56 short stories and 4 novels starring Sherlock Holmes, in each of which Holmes demonstrated the powers of deduction. "There is nothing more deceptive than an obvious fact," he said. "It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts." And it's the birthday of Peter Matheson, born in New York City, 1927, joined the Navy during World War II, went on to Yale. One of his professors at Yale asked if Matheson would like to work for the CIA, which was newly formed. Matheson asked if he could be sent to Paris, and the professor agreed. "So," Matheson said, "out of sheer greed and opportunism, off I went." The CIA helped fund Matheson's founding of the Paris Review, and in Paris, Matheson infiltrated the circle of French communists to find out what they were up to. But as the McCarthy trials got attention in America, Matheson resigned from the CIA. He spent 3 years working unsuccessfully as a commercial fisherman on Long Island, and in 1956, at the age of 29, took off across the country in a Ford with a sleeping bag, some books, a shotgun, and wrote a book about it called Wildlife in America, which caught the eye of the New Yorker magazine, where Matheson wrote about a trip to the Amazon, went on to write novels, including At Play in the Fields of the Lord and The Snow Leopard. Here's a poem for today by Hal Sirovitz, What Followed Your Birth. "You might not like being reminded of your birthday," Father said, "but your mother and I do. Your birth was a happy occasion. What followed was both good and bad. That was to be expected. But what we didn't expect was that you'd be the last of your friends to get a job, which you still haven't gotten yet. It just took you longer to get started. You had to go back to school. That wouldn't have been so bad if you were learning something. But after all these years, to still not know what you want for a present doesn't speak well for education. A poem by Hal Sierovitz, What Followed Your Birth, from his collection Father Said, published by Soft Skull Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering writing about finances, food, art, wine, and culture from around the world. More at wsj.com/